Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 1978, Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. It's supposed to protect expecting mothers at work, and it requires companies to accommodate pregnant workers' requests, say, lighter lifting or less standing, but only if that company is making accommodations for other workers, quote, similar in their ability or inability to work. Well, that little hitch is one of the reasons why, 40 years later, pregnant women are still reporting workplace discrimination. In some cases, they're losing their jobs, and in other cases, even miscarrying at work. This hour on Point, pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. And you can join us. We want to hear your stories. Did your employer refuse to provide some or any accommodations to you when you were pregnant? Or did you have the opposite experience and have a very accommodating employer? What happened? How much should a company be required to shift a worker's duties around her pregnancy? And what are the costs and limits to that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us today are Natalie Kitroff and Jessica Silver Greenberg. They co-reported a special New York Times story, investigative series, about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. And we've got links to their reporting at onpointradio.org. Jessica Silver Greenberg, welcome to you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. And Natalie Kitroff, welcome as well to the program.
It's great to be here.
So you wrote a multi-part story that really kind of explored broad-based examples of discrimination in different kinds of workplaces, but also specifically the kind of challenges that pregnant women are facing in very physically intensive jobs. And I just wanted to start there a little bit. For example, you talked to a woman named Otisha Woolbright. She used to work at a Walmart. Can you tell us the story of Otisha and what happened to her?
So Otisha was working in the deli and the bakery at a Walmart, and she was lifting heavy trays of chicken. She asked her employer to be able to stop lifting those heavy trays, and her employer, or her manager in this case, told her no and said, actually, I saw a video of Demi Moore doing a somersault when she was almost full term. So pregnancy should be no excuse for you.
Yeah. Well, can I just jump in here? Because we actually have sound of Otisha of telling exactly this part of the story, because she did an interview, obviously with you two, but also with the New York Times podcast, The Daily, in June. And so you're going to hear Otisha here describing what happened, this moment that happened with her supervisor. And I should say, as both of you reported, she had already been told by her doctor that a heavy lifting of those 50-pound trays of chicken could have put her or would have put her at risk of miscarriage. So in this tape, Otisha Woolbright describes the conversation that she had with her Walmart supervisor.
I told her, the doctor told me no heavy lifting for over more than 20 pounds. But my job consisted me to do heavy lifting. She told me Demi Moore did somersaults on the stage at 9 months pregnant. If Demi Moore could do it, there shouldn't be no problem with me working.
Wow. And so, Jessica and Natalie, what happened to Otisha after that?
She ultimately was fired from her job at Walmart, and she's currently suing the company. But essentially, she went into a deep depression, which she talks about really poignantly, because of this situation. So she's still struggling financially because of this decision, essentially, to deny her accommodations.
Yeah, she had asked for maternity leave and, as you said, was fired when she was 7 months pregnant?
That's right.
Okay. So that's one example of a hardworking woman who couldn't find even the slightest accommodation with a major American corporation. I mean, how did Walmart respond to your inquiries about Otisha Woolbright's case?
Walmart said that they basically responded with a blanket denial. They said that Otisha and a number of other women who are all suing Walmart, alleging pretty much the same fact pattern, were all kind of confused, that they so they denied ever denying those women accommodations that they needed. And in this instance, it's a, you know, it's an example of, you know, the what the company said versus what all these women say. Mm-hmm. And what we found striking in our reporting was just the volume of women, the number of women who, said again and again a very starkly similar set of facts.
And is there evidence that, that volume is growing over time? Because I think didn't you report that complaints to the EEOC, for example, are they at or near an all-time high?
So the complaints to the EEOC, you're absolutely right, are at an all-time high. Those aren't Walmart specific,
right? There is across all employers in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah. But so you were talking about the number of complaints that you heard specifically regarding Walmart then?
Yeah, we interviewed a number of women, both mostly former but some current employees of Walmart, who said that they were, like Otisha, denied any respite from heavy lifting when they would ask. So what we saw again and again, the pattern that we saw is that Walmart at some point – you know, changed its policy toward pregnant women. Uh-huh. But that policy, as far as we can tell, has not trickled down, so to speak, to the floor of these stores where women are working and where they're hoisting these heavy trays and lifting these heavy boxes. So while what might be on the books is an improvement for women, managers are not implementing that.
Okay. Now, I want to talk for a few more minutes before we get to sort of the bigger picture issues here, because I want to talk about another example at a Verizon warehouse that you reported on the Mississippi-Tennessee border, because the stories coming out of this one warehouse were just shocking, really. So can you tell us a little bit about the warehouse and the company that runs it?
So the warehouse is, it handles Verizon products, cell phones, tablets, other accessories. And it's run by a third-party contractor called XPO Logistics. It's a vast warehouse. It's sort of windowless, beige. And inside, workers are packing, moving, often lifting boxes up to 45 pounds in what can be really extreme heat. So heat that can hit and rise above 100 degrees inside the warehouse. And so we found six women who had had miscarriages in under very similar circumstances. These were women who had begged for a reprieve from the heavy lifting. And there were areas of the warehouse where they could have worked and not lifted these boxes. So you could have handled paperwork. You could have sat behind a computer all day, you could have mailed SIM cards. But when there was a holiday rush at this warehouse, these women were often sent to the area where they were lifting the heaviest boxes. And in some cases, they brought in doctor's notes specifically recommending, urging that these women not do this work, that they be given regular breaks. And those doctor's notes, they say, were ignored by their managers, again, at XPO Logistics.
I mean, you tell the story. I'm sorry, can I just jump in here? Because the stories are genuine. They're so heartbreaking. I'm thinking of Erica Hayes, who spoke to you, who miscarried at work with blood drenching her jeans. She had to go to the bathroom, have this miscarriage, and fainted on her way out of the bathroom.
Yeah. And to be clear, so at that point in 2014, the warehouse was run by a different company called New Breed that was bought by XPO. But yes, Erica Hayes had spent a lot of time in December lifting these heavy boxes. It was a holiday rush. In the beginning of January 2014, one day after a long shift of this lifting, she ran to the bathroom. She felt blood drenching her jeans, pooling there. And on her way out of the bathroom, on the way to her car, and, you know, her coworkers were preparing a pea coat for her to put around her waist to cover the stain of the blood. They were preparing plastic bags to put on the leather seats of her car so that she wouldn't stain it. She fainted on the way out of the bathroom, never made it to the car. She was taken out by an ambulance and eventually learned that she had miscarried. And this is a woman who had asked repeatedly, again, for a break from lifting these heavy boxes to be permanently taken out of this area, and it was those requests, she said, were repeatedly ignored.
Yeah. Now, as you said, Natalie and Jessica, XPO, the company, a spokeswoman did tell you that, you know, some of these incidences happened before XPO acquired this warehouse. But they also say that some of the allegations, or all said the allegations, are, quote, unsubstantiated, filled with inaccuracies, and do not reflect the way in which our Memphis facility operates. So are they disputing some of the conditions that these reporters were working, or what actually happened?
They are. So it's there's a kind of double-barreled denial in that statement. So the first is, you know, that some of the miscarriages happened before they acquired New Breed, so before they were in charge, which is, you know, absolutely, we state that in the story.
Yeah.
So some of the miscarriages happened during this particularly brutal set of months in 2014. And that was before they acquired the warehouse. Now, as to their second denial that these incidents occurred, that one's a lot trickier. And what was compelling to us is that, women who still work at the warehouse, so who still depend on these jobs for their livelihood, said with their names attached, they were willing to stand up and be counted and say, this is still very much happening. This is happening to us right now. And those stories were corroborated by 20 former and current employees, all who work at that Memphis warehouse.
And XPO still denies those allegations, huh?
Yeah, in a statement.
Well, Jessica Silver Greenberg and Natalie Kitroev, they co-reported a special New York Times series about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, sometimes leading to catastrophic outcomes like the miscarriages we've been talking about. We'll be right back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. There was a special New York Times investigative series that took a look into incidences of, in some cases, extreme incidences of alleged pregnancy discrimination and what happened and why. That series was co-reported by Jessica Silver Greenberg and Natalie Kitroev, and they join us today. And we also want to hear from you, do you think that workplace accommodations for expecting mothers have gotten better in the 40 years since the first law about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace was passed? Did you ask for accommodations from your employer and got them? Or were you even afraid to ask, concerned about whether or not having your work changed because of your pregnancy might affect your job or possibly even lead to your dismissal? Also want to hear from employers about the situation from your point of view. If you're an employer, how much accommodation can you make? And what are the realistic concerns that employers have about the limits to accommodating employees during pregnancy? Now, I just want to play a little tape for you because there are a lot of stories out there. You're going to hear from Heather Myers. She was working at a Walmart in Kansas in 2006 when she discovered she was pregnant. She talked to NPR in 2014 about it. And she said that while her doctor had recommended that she keep a water bottle with her on the Walmart sales floor, her supervisor did not approve. So Myers went back to her doctor and got a note to give to her supervisor.
She said, I'm sorry, but we can't accept your doctor's note because we have water available to you because you have the water fountains available to you. I was just a little shocked that this water bottle was kind of becoming this big deal, and they were even scrutinizing my doctor's notes. I decided to go against what my supervisor suggested and listen to my doctor and to my body and decided to keep the water bottle. And one day that supervisor came up to me and she said, either the water bottle has to go or you have to go.
That's Heather Meyer. She spoke with NPR in 2014. Now, Jessica Silver Greenberg and Natalie Kitroeff, in the course of your reporting, were you surprised by the number of stories that you found, or was it still difficult to get women to come forward to talk about discrimination that they felt they had experienced in the workplace while they were pregnant?
So I think we were surprised when we first started reporting this story by just how common mm-hmm. this experience was. When you start something like this, we had been looking for something that might be impacting women the way that Me Too has. And we were shocked at the outpouring of sort of very similar experiences from women all the way up and down the economic ladder in blue-collar jobs and low-wage jobs and office jobs. For this most recent story on miscarriage, I can say that we went to Texas together. I mean, to Texas, to Memphis mm-hmm. together. We had to, in many cases, go back to the same women over and over and over again and really gain their trust, because what we were talking about here was one of the most personal and devastating experiences of their life. So in the case of a miscarriage or a really deeply affecting health experience, it was difficult to get people to talk to us.
Yeah. And I imagine that the extreme difficulty that the women who were, you know, ultimately willing to speak to you, that their extreme difficulty was compounded by the fact that I would guess almost all of them really needed the jobs they were in, right? It wasn't as if they had the freedom or the means to just say, okay, well, if you're not going to accommodate me, I'll go find another employer.
Right. And they also needed the health insurance that came with those jobs. They
were their prenatal pregnant. Care, yeah.
Exactly. So it was a paycheck and it was also health insurance. And again, Jess and I talked to people who were still working at the warehouse. So these are folks who are at, again, great personal risk coming forward to tell their stories when, you know, it could risk their job.
Right. Now, I want to get to the bigger picture here, but I should note that the warehouse company that many of these women, or all the women in your second story, most of them that where they worked, did the company not also say that they dispute the allegations because of currently are there attempts to unionize employees at the warehouse?
Yes, they did say that. They said that they believed that these allegations were manufactured, drummed up, and exaggerated by the Teamsters Union, which is currently trying to organize the warehouse. What we found, though, there's a couple of points to kind of mention on that. So with the exception of one woman, Tasha Morrell, who ultimately left the warehouse and has become an organizer with the Teamsters, none of the women were affiliated with the union at all. So none of the women who used their names were affiliated with the union at all. And you have to put the denial by XPO and pointing to the Teamsters in a broader context, which is, they made a lot of denials, some of which we included on the record. So and it comes down to a pretty basic set of disputed facts. So for instance, we described the warehouse at the beginning of the story as beige and windowless. Mm-hmm. The company disputed the description of windowless, pointing out that while the warehouse has no exterior windows, it has a number of interior windows.
So they don't actually see sunlight or daylight. They're just inside the building.
Right. There are windows that I'm not exactly sure what interior windows they're describing. I believe that those exist. But when you're evaluating the credibility of a statement, I think you need – and the credibility of a denial, I do think you have to look at the facts that they are disputing that are smaller than, say – you know, whether or not a woman had a miscarriage on the warehouse
right.
floor.
I mean, I'm sitting in a radio studio right now, and there is an interior window. I can see out into the hallway of our radio station. But
yes, I'm in a similar studio. I can also see into a room
okay.
where a man is working.
So, you know what? I want to get into sort of the legal framework that all of this is going on in, you know, across the country here in just a minute with both of you, Jessica and Natalie. But we have a lot of callers who want to join us. So let's get some of their stories in if I can. So let's go to Joanna, who's calling from Edmond, Oklahoma. Joanna, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, my experience was, I just wanted to kind of share because it hit home. I was working for oil and gas about 6 years ago when I became pregnant with our first son. And because I was a private contractor, I wasn't fired, but I was let go as soon as it kind of became known that I was pregnant. And I guess the biggest thing was it was the only other girl or woman in the office was the only one to help me bring my chair down like two or three stories, as well as all my other things. And all these other men were just sitting there. And what I thought were like at least coworkers, like a friend level on that level, it didn't prove to be. And it just makes me so sad that actually I just saw that friend of mine and she's pregnant and she's now an attorney. A title attorney, and she's having the same problems. And so it's still very relevant. And I don't know if it's just oil and gas, a good old boy kind of thing, but I just really hope and pray that, well, you know, we see the day that men really want to look out for their women too and just help us.
Well, Joanna,
we can do the work, you know.
Yeah. Joanna, thank you so much for your call, and thank you for sharing your story. Let's get another story in here. Aaron is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I work for a media company, and I worked nights on a live news shift for a newspaper. And throughout the years of the company, I'd worked down to only one night a week. And while I was pregnant with my firstborn, while I was finding out the sex of the child, I was informed through an email that I'd be going to three nights a week. And when I returned to work the next day and asked the male supervisor why I was chosen when there were employees with less experience, employees with no children, not even married, without any thought of having children, why I was chosen, my only explanation was if I complained anymore, I could be working all nights. And lucky for me, the supervisor moved on with a new job, but it was still astonishing that he himself was, you know, a father of two children, a daughter himself, and to think that, you know, they could treat women in their workforce that way, but not potentially think that their daughters could be treated that way in the future is just astounding to me.
Yeah.
And I have to say that my company has made a lot of changes since then and now has a work from home policy. And I no longer work live new shifts. I get to work advanced new shifts for the weekend, which allows me to, with working from home with my children, I don't have to work necessarily a straight 8 hours during the day. I can be very flexible and take my children to doctor's appointments or pick them up from school if they are sick. And I'm really happy about the strides my company has made. But that time when I was pregnant, it was still so devastating to me. And I still worked nights the first two years of my children's lives.
Right.
And I just hope that other women get to, you know, now there's other women at the company pregnant, and I'm really grateful that they get to be at home, especially during those hours, those first few weeks of morning sickness or, you know,
tell
when
me about it. Aaron, thank you so much for your call. I'm just kind of reflecting on my own personal experience, having gone through this a couple of times as well. But I'm glad to hear, Aaron, by the way, that there have been improvements in sort of workplace culture and practices where you are, because I presume that those improvements are benefiting everyone, which is great to hear. And it's one of the issues that I want to take up a little later in this hour. But let's get one more call in here. Andrea is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air, Andrea.
Hey, similar to your other callers, I just kind of wanted to share my experience. I was a public school special education teacher, and I primarily worked with children with severe autism. I did have two aides in my classroom, but they were documented as, you know, not being qualified or helpful and would frequently just, like, leave the classroom without any explanation. And I was pregnant last year, and I did have a student who, you know, as happens daily, would have a tantrum, and he was kicking me in the stomach repeatedly while I was pregnant. And I did end up miscarrying a few days later at school in the morning, again, while I was handling another student. I don't know if any of you guys have had a miscarriage, but just the cramping came on real severe, and I was walked to the front office bleeding through my pants, similar to another story. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to share.
Yeah. Andrea, so first of all, I'm so sorry to hear about what happened to you. But just to be clear, did you I didn't quite get, like, did you ask for any potential changes, or were, you know, given the job that you have, what changes could have been made to sort of to help you? Because I understand you're, like, in close contact with your students. I mean, what accommodations could be made?
Essentially none. I didn't even ask, to be honest with you. I did tell my vice principal that I was pregnant. I did tell my aides and asked them, you know, when things got physical, if they could step in, which is certainly appropriate. My job as a teacher is the education portion and the behavior management. The physical stuff is typically done by the aides anyways. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of let them know, you know, hey guys, you're really going to have to step in. I just can't do it. I'm pregnant. And they have, you know, they up front we're like, yeah, sure, but the behaviors continued where they would just walk out the classroom or take extremely long breaks. I also did not have any kind of break at all, no planning, no lunch. Uh-huh. I worked from 7 until 4 every day. Yeah. With nothing. So, well, that was not helpful either.
Andrea, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your story. Jessica Silver-Greenberg and Natalie Kitroev, they are the co-reporters of this New York Times special series on pregnancy discrimination. Jessica and Natalie, I'm going to ask you, you've been really patient here. I just wanted to get a lot of those additional stories in, but I'm going to ask you to stand by for one more minute here because I want to introduce Joan Williams into the conversation. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, and director of the Center for Work-Life Law there, and she joins us today from San Francisco. Joan Williams, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
So the big question here now, after we've heard the extensive reporting from Jessica and Natalie and those three stories from women who just called us, is what rights do pregnant women have in the workplace to ask for accommodations? I mean, there is a law from 1978 on the books. What does that law purportedly do?
There are actually two laws that give women far more rights than people typically know they have. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which is the law from the 70s, says that if you accommodate people who aren't pregnant, very often you have to accommodate people. Well, you have to accommodate people who are. And that may give you additional rights. But the other law is the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. Now, that pregnancy is not a disability, but a lot of the conditions incident to pregnancy are disabilities. For example, lots of women get carpal tunnel as a result of pregnancy. So it doesn't make any sense that you have to accommodate women with carpal tunnel, which is a known disability, so long as it's not incident to pregnancy. So for many of the kinds of conditions that women typically need accommodations, they are entitled to accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, even if the Pregnancy Discrimination Act doesn't help them.
But what about the cases that Jessica and Natalie reported where women were told they were at risk of miscarriage and that risk was exacerbated because of the nature of the highly physical labor they were doing? I mean, that's not necessarily a disability. It's a risk. So what rights did they have?
It depends on the medical condition, and this is exactly why we need a federal law that addresses directly the women's need for accommodations. It's been proposed. It's called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. But depending on the specific conditions they had, they might well have been entitled to accommodations, under one of these existing laws. The problem is it's a patchwork. It's very complicated. We actually have a website at Work Life Law to help. It's called Pregnant at Work, to help pregnant women know what their rights are. And we have a website to help doctors get them disability leave or disability accommodations if they need it. But yeah, it's really complicated. That's why we need the law.
Jessica and Natalie, we've just got about 30 seconds here before the break. But as far as I understand it, the major loophole in the law as it stands right now is if a company doesn't offer accommodations to anyone, they don't have to offer accommodations to pregnant women.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, and the women in the warehouse, you know, they didn't have any specific condition. They were just told that in some cases they had high risk pregnancies. Some had given birth preterm before. But these were women who were in a workplace that did not accommodate anyone. So that workplace had no obligation under federal law to accommodate them.
Well, Natalie Kitroff, Jessica Silver-Greenberg, and Professor Joan Williams, hang on here for just a second. We got to take a quick break. We're talking about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace today. And the New York Times recently had a special investigative series on this topic. It was reported by Jessica Silver-Greenberg and Natalie Kitroff. They join us today from New York. I'm also joined by Joan Williams. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, and director of the Center for Work-Life Law there. And let's go through the phones once again and take a call from Lee, who's calling from Fort Mill, South Carolina. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi. I figured I could be the token male. I was a nurse for 15 years, working in a profession that is only 3-4% male. One of the three of the people that you've had speak, each one of them went right beyond accommodation, which of a disability, however temporary, to a plea for preferential treatment. And I'm specifically talking about one of the ladies who mentioned that people didn't understand she had children and that they assigned her shifts that could have been assigned to the childless, the single, but that they didn't accommodate that she had children. That goes way beyond any workplace accommodation. I was also a paralegal for a decade, mm-hmm, doing workers' comp and injury. If there's a lot of requests for understanding in a situation in which accommodating physical disability, which is simplifies my talking about being pregnant, is I've stood on floors and watched, and it's one thing to say, well, you don't have to do X, Y, or Z because you're having morning sickness or accommodating some, you know, hey, they're going to come get me when I was a male nurse because I could pick somebody up. It didn't matter just because she weighs 98 pounds. She can't lift like I can. Okay, but some of those are simple.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start moving into that you shouldn't have to work nights, they should go pick on the single people who don't have children, that's a different basis for outright discrimination.
Yeah. Lee, I hear you, actually, and I want to turn your call back to our guest here. But Lee's call actually makes me think, and Joan Williams, I'm going to turn this to you, but Lee's call makes me think of the 2015 Supreme Court case, Young versus UPS. And give me a second here to set this up, right? Because I think it was the last time or one of the more recent times that that we as a nation sort of talked about actively about pregnancy in the workplace. So this is when UPS driver Peggy Young's doctor said she shouldn't be lifting heavy packages because it put her at risk of miscarriage. So she was told to stay home, meaning she lost her medical coverage. And so she sued UPS. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in a 2014 interview with MSNBC, Peggy Young described what happened.
So I went into the doctor and got a note with my restrictions, and I turned the note in, and basically they said, you know, we don't provide light duty for pregnancy. Go home till you're no longer pregnant.
I should say in 2015, the Supreme Court actually ruled in her favor, 6-3 in her favor. But Joan Williams, my question comes to you because I was looking at the dissent in that Supreme Court case. It was written by Justice Scalia. It's a really interesting dissent, and I think Lee's call echoes a lot of what Justice Scalia said back then. He wrote, for example, that prohibiting employers from making any distinctions between pregnant workers and others of similar ability would elevate pregnant workers to most favored employees. Then he gives an example, theoretically. If Boeing offered chauffeurs to injured directors, it would have to offer chauffeurs to pregnant mechanics. And if Disney paid pensions to workers who can no longer work because of old age, it would have to pay pensions to workers who cannot work because of childbirth. So he says it's implausible that current federal law, which elsewhere creates guarantees of equal treatment, here alone creates the guarantee of favored treatment. What do you think about that?
Well, that's not true. Lee does have a good point. It's not illegal, but it's very bad practice to, every time you have an undesirable shift, give it to somebody who's single who doesn't have or doesn't have kids in order to accommodate parents. On the other hand, that's not typically the discrimination in the workplace is very, very strong against pregnant women and mothers. The fact is there are a lot of situations, for example, someone with diabetes needs to take breaks to eat. Well, somebody who is extremely nauseated because of pregnancy needs to take breaks to eat. What's the difference? And what we have seen is that employers who accommodate the person with diabetes often don't accommodate the person with a pregnancy. In blue-collar context, and I think about what Joanna said, she said, we can do the work. I remember reading one woman saying, I can do the work. It's the men I can't take. And that's exactly what Joanna was saying, that often in blue-collar contexts, women can do the work. But the employer, my sense in reading hundreds of these cases, is the employer didn't want to hire these women in the first place, and so figures, great, I'm just going to wait until they're pregnant, then I can force them out on leave and fire them. And that's what the Young versus UPS decision began to put an end to.
Mm. Now, Jessica Silver Greenberg and Natalie Kitteroff, there have been attempts, though, since at least 2012, right, to provide some kind of upgrade or modernization of laws around pregnancy in the workplace.
There have been. So Joan mentioned the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act.
Yeah.
And that's been the kind of centerpiece of efforts to strengthen the federal law, fill in the gaps that exist in the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. There have been efforts since every congressional session since 2012, lawmakers have introduced the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. So far, it has not made it out of committee. So it has not made it out of the HELP committee, which stands for Health and Labor and Pensions. I'm not going to get the exact terms right, but it's never had a hearing. And it has bipartisan support. It now has bipartisan support. Kind of not ironically, but interestingly, the chairman of that committee, Lamar Alexander, his home state is where that XPO warehouse is based, mm-hmm. So Tennessee.
And so, but you're saying that it hasn't actually sort of advanced to any, it hasn't ever even advanced to a vote or debate.
It's never been put on the floor. No, you're right. It's never had a hearing.
Okay, so Joan Williams, let me just hop back to you here. I mean, is what you see in this proposal, even if it's not going anywhere in Congress yet, is it taking us in the right direction?
It's taking us in the right direction, and in fact, something like 22 states already have similar provisions. There should be a national law that says workers are sometimes women. Women sometimes get pregnant, and you have to accommodate them when they do. On the other hand, I think it's really important to recognize that pregnant women already do have sweeping rights, and they actually have rights even if the employer has accommodated nobody else, potentially, under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So any pregnant worker who was in a situation like those described in the article or listening, please go to Pregnant at Work to ensure that you can exercise the legal rights that you have, because pregnant workers already have a lot of rights under existing law. That doesn't mean we don't need a new law, because the situation is very complicated. We need to simplify it for employers and employees.
So, Jessica and Natalie, though, I wonder, I mean, you spoke to so many women in the process of reporting this story. Even with what Joan Williams just said, that the ADA might cover a lot of women in the accommodations they could need while pregnant, I imagine that you ran into folks who were saying, well, I'm hesitant to ask because of how my employer might see me. I'm hesitant in terms of I don't want them to reduce my pay or limit my future advancement, or just that it would change sort of how they're seen in the workplace, which then could have future effects even after their children are born.
So, right. So the women that we talked to were overwhelmingly women who, as you point out, Meghna, they're in jobs that they need desperately. They're making close to minimum wage. They have very little resources. They are pregnant at the most vulnerable moment in their life. They are sick. They are nauseated. They are lifting heavy boxes every day, and they need a paycheck, and they need health insurance. These are not women with access to lawyers, and sometimes they don't have access to the internet. So, you know, what we saw was that there is, and, you know, you said that they're in some cases they're fearful to ask. What we saw was that even when they ask, even when they demand these rights, they're being told no. And, you know, I think Joan is right that there is a patchwork of laws here that may, in one case or another, actually technically on paper provide protections. But the reality on the ground for women in these low wage conditions is that the employer has a loophole to go through under federal law. It isn't clear. They don't have lawyers. And so the result is that they're asked, they're denied, and they keep working because they feel like they have to. And that's when you see these extreme, tragic consequences. Yeah.
Well, let's take one more call here. Dean is calling from Pasadena, Maryland. Dean, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Dean. Go ahead.
So I'm calling, I guess, on behalf of the employer. We are an organization that does have, we offer hospice and palliative care. So we do have folks that are hands-on doing very difficult, heavy work, transferring patients and the like. And we take this this type of situation very seriously. I can say that I'm proud that we're about 86 to 87% female population. Cooler heads prevail usually and maybe make smarter decisions. But we do our best to treat people fairly. Mm-hmm. We definitely take a second to pause and review the situation and consider everything on a case by case. We evaluate precedents. We try and determine what's reasonable. And in most cases, we do go above and beyond to try and treat people fairly and do what we can to both manage the business and the operation and the needs of our population we serve, but also keep in mind the needs of the employees.
Right. So can I just jump in here, Dean? Because I'm really glad you called, and thank you. Because I'm wondering from the employer's perspective, what are all the parts of the decision that go into figuring out how much accommodation is possible or should be possible for a pregnant employee? Because to be frank, I'm wondering if you'd talk to us about, are there costs decisions? Are there productivity issues? Are there, other, you know, the staffing around that person? I mean, what is it that you have to think of when you're considering what accommodations the company ought to make?
Sure. I don't think cost really comes into play until probably very late in the decision process, if at all. Usually involves staffing. So, you know, we provide medical care. So we always have to think about the needs of the patients and covering all the patients that we have. And being a highly female population, we do have quite a number of our employees out for maternity and other related types of needs for leave. So staffing usually is the key decision, making sure that we're not overburdening the rest of the team to cover the patient load that the absent individual has. But we obviously have to kind of consider the whole situation and what's best and navigate the alphabet soup that is the regulatory landscape and really just figure out what is the best. I mean, we've actually had folks that within their first few weeks of hire weren't eligible for any type of leave, not even the accrued leave that we offer, and allow them to go out on extended leave to take care of their own pregnancy or, you know, after having just given birth, be able to be with a preemie or, you know, at home with their family and so forth. So, well, again, it really depends on the situation and what we're able to do.
Dean, thank you so very much for your call. Jessica and Natalie and Joan, and Joan, I'll start with you here in the last couple minutes that we have. I mean, we've talked about the legal framework that that expecting mothers are operating in right now in terms of the ADA and the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. But I'm also wondering whether we ought to be discussing that changes in the workplace or how we change how we work, while they may be things that accommodate women or pregnant women, are actually possibly good for all workers. And that in the 21st century, since women are everywhere in every workplace, that perhaps we ought to be looking at this as something that could benefit everyone.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, traditionally, we've defined the ideal worker as someone who takes no time off for childbearing, child rearing, or really anything else, and shows up 9 to 5 every day at the same place. That is so wildly outdated. And as someone who's been working on these issues since the 1980s, I mean, I was really delighted when one of the callers said that now she can work from home, for example, and she can work flexible hours. Now, there's some jobs in which that's not feasible. You can't do that if you're a cashier. But you can do that in a very, very broad range of jobs. And I'll just give one example. One major hotel chain allowed hotel housekeepers to come in whenever they wanted before 10 o'clock and leave when they finished their rooms. And they were moved to tears by this. They worked better. It was better for the employer. And it was so much better for the women. One woman said, I've gone to church for the first time with my family in 12 years. And so it's employers like Lee who really can lead the way in making the workplace better for everybody.
Yeah. Well, Jessica and Natalie, though, I'm thinking of the women that you talked to who are working in that Tennessee warehouse, that perhaps that kind of flexibility doesn't seem imaginable for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, these are women who described knowing when they would come in the morning when they had to report for work, but not knowing when they would be allowed to leave. Women who had no control over their schedules or their shifts. And what we're seeing in the broader economy is that there are pressures driven by Amazon and other huge logistics behemoths to get things, goods, to people's doors faster. And cheaper. And so those pressures then fall on workers like Erica Hayes and like Seadria Walker, who are then asked to pack more boxes in a smaller amount of time.
Well, Jessica Silver Greenberg and Natalie Kitroev, they co-reported this New York Times special series on pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. Thank you to both of you so much. And Joan Williams, professor of law at University of California, Hastings, thank you to you as well. We've got links to the reporting and interesting resources at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.